Cinephile. Nicolas Cage.
Very sincere group of film enthusiasts who are proudly cinephiles.
Oh my goodness! Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible! Oh, Moonlight won Best Picture!
Cinephile. Ethan Hawke.
It's kind of like I'm a professional actor and I direct for love. There's so much in this world that's dividing us, and music is one of those great tools that brings us together.
Paul Rudd.
There's baseball and World War II. It's kind of a dream.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
All right, yes. Why wasn't I still recording?
That would have been gold. Could have run that as the open.
Spike Lee would contend, I guess, that the sober approach will no longer suffice if the age we inhabit is too drunk on its own craziness. He has a point. That's from Anthony Lane of The New Yorker, his review of BlacKkKlansman, Spike Lee's roaring return to form, 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, fifth at the box office, 10.8 million in 1,500 screens. Speaking of box office, Alec Bloom is going to be our special guest today. He knows everything when it comes to the box office because he works for Fantasy Movie League. Check out the app. Our friend Matthew Berry, of course, is a big part of that as well. And so Alec is going to tell us the box office winners and losers. Documentaries did great. Which superhero movies were a disappointment? Which ones could still do well later in the year? So, and plus, he's got some great trivia for us. God, I mean, he knows cinephiles, so he tailored it towards me and my boys, Dan Stanzik and Rick Passmore. There are references to Paul Giamatti and Al Pacino and Robert De Niro and Stanley Tucci, and my guy did his homework, so thanks to Alec for doing that. And a welcome back to all of you. Been a minute, as the kids say. A solid month without Cinephile. A major milestone as I turned 40, and thanks to Dan Stanzik for being a part of the birthday video, which my wife surprised me with. I am so insecure about turning 40, so thankfully my friend Gabe Oppenheim gave me some movie-related things about it. He pointed out, because he knows Akira is my favorite Kurosawa movie, and he said, well, he made it when he was 42, and he didn't get it released till he was 48, and also that Yasujiro Ozu made Tokyo Story in his 50s, and Kurosawa was making movies into his 80s, so that's all good news. But I always go back to the fact Orson Welles made the greatest movie ever made when he was 25 years old. So you know what? Past 25, it's all downhill from there. But thanks to everybody as I now reach middle age. I'm so insecure, too. Now, I ask people randomly, I go, how old do you think I look? And they're like, I don't know, 36. I'm like, yeah, all right, I got 4 years off. That's great. Like, I'm getting 36, 37, 38. So I'm like, all right, hey, shave 2 years off. I'm like, all right, it's a win. Pathetic. We got lots of movies to review. So in the interest of expediency, I'm going to review a few of these first, and we're going to talk to Alec, and then I'm going to just, like, try to hammer through, which I recognize are not to everyone's taste, the foreign films and the children's movies that I saw. So let's devote a lot of our time here to BlacKkKlansman and Spike Lee. You know, with Spike Lee, he's going to make a provocative film, and it's going to be about race in America. But it's been an awfully long time since he was relevant. And as I tweeted, this was his best film since Inside Man, which Dan had last time as his focus on Every Man, a movie that he loves, and rightfully so. So this is the first great movie Spike's made in 12 years. And somebody rightfully tweeted me, well, it's not like saying much. I'm like, well, you're right. The Sweet Blood of Jesus, Chi-Raq was a mess, a musical set in Chicago. John Cusack's playing this preacher. It was all over the place. Miracle at St. Anna, which I think is terrible. Ben Lyons actually likes it, which is amazing. At 33% of Rotten Tomatoes, a friend of mine was like laughing in the theater at the end. He was like, it was just like preposterous. 2 hours and 40-minute war movie. I mean, it's been bad. And I often wonder, like with actors and artists, just like with athletes, I think sometimes you just get past your prime. Like, I worry about it with Mamet. He's 70 years old. I'm like, he hasn't made anything relevant in over a decade. Like, you've got so much to say, you put out your creative output, and then eventually it just dries up on you. And I was worried with Spike. I said, maybe he's just, those great movies that I love, Do the Right Thing and Malcolm X are my top 10 all time. You know, I love jazz, so I love Mo Better Blues, and Denzel playing this trumpeter, conflicted about emotion, and Spike's dad was a jazz musician, and the way he ends it with Coltrane's A Love Supreme. I think Jungle Fever is a really prescient movie about interracial relationships back in 1991. Crooklyn, if you like a good family movie. He Got Game is obviously a great basketball movie Dan loves. So I'm like, there was that era, like whatever, when Spike was churning out from, like, She's Gotta Have It, School Days, his first two films, but like from 89 to 98, it was like, yeah, 25th Hour, I think, has some great moments in there. Wonderful ending. Very melancholy. I like Ed Norton's One Rant, which is an homage to Do the Right Thing. Clockers, I think, is very underrated. So my point is that he had this incredible run. He was clearly one of the best directors in America. But then just, you know, the documentaries are notable. Four Little Girls certainly is impactful. When the Levees Broke, his Hurricane Katrina documentaries. But then just some of these movies weren't weren't as successful. And I think credit goes to Spike A for still making movies. You know, Ben Lyons and me, he's like Woody Allen. He just keeps churning them out. Even if they're good or not, there's enough of audience for Spike. And he's not a guy who needs a big budget. Give me $4 or $5 million, I'll make the movie. So when it came to Black Klansman, Jordan Peele called him and goes, I got six words for you. Black man infiltrates KKK. And he's like, what? And Spike said the first thing he thought about was the famous Chappelle sketch. And he's like, no, this is like a real thing. This is a guy named Ron Stallworth, and he was a police officer in the Colorado Springs who impersonated a white voice and then had a proxy go there and actually infiltrate the KKK. So Spike was like, let's do this. And I love the tagline for it. And we've talked in the past about great taglines. Infiltrate hate. Great tagline for Black Klansman. So you would think that, you know, all the notes add up here for Spike as far as a movie that he can make. And it got rave reviews at the Cannes Film Festival. He won the Grand Prix, which is the runner-up prize. And I'm just thrilled to see a great artist back in his groove, right? It's just good to see somebody who can still hit a fastball out of the park, and Spike does it. And I think you know going in it's going to be a film that's very provocative, and it's very timely about race, and he's certainly drawing allusions to the present-day administration, what was happening in the 1970s, and the audience is laughing along with a couple of jokes, and he's clearly, I mean, subtlety is never a strength of Spike's. He's going to let you know what he feels. Even the open, not to spoil it too much for people, but it's Alec Baldwin who's playing this racist, who's spewing it. And so the first thing about Alec Baldwin, of course, is Trump. And then the movie ends with Trump and Charlottesville. And the movie was very much timed to coincide with what happened in Charlottesville a year ago. But I'll say this. If you're somebody who doesn't want all that political stuff, if you're someone, let's say you're a Trump supporter and say, okay, listen, I'm tired of hearing that Trump's racist and I don't want to hear about this and I want to focus on the period piece. I do think Black Klansman is still very successful as a story about undercover police work. As a guy who likes a good cop movie, I thought that aspect of it was still very strong. So I think that's important to tell you. I don't want to browbeat you and say, oh, it's a Spike Lee movie, so it's a lot about race and black versus white. Well, yeah, but it's also really fascinating about undercover police work. And if you like Donnie Brasco, as I do, then you'll love this movie and those scenes where Adam Driver's playing this undercover cop who's pretending to be this virulent racist and yet is worried about being found out. So I think, again, kind of like Inside Man, which is an atypical Spike film that you don't think it has its hallmarks, it still is an entertaining genre film. And he fits within that genre while still putting in his own flourishes and touches. And the real surprise is this, it's awfully funny. And that's what I was really happy that Spike was able to do. There are scenes that are cringeworthy. I mean, it's you want to take a shower. It's just painful the way the KKK is talking about blacks and gays and Jews in America. And it's just so hateful. And yet Spike was so smart to say, but I've got to have scenes of levity. And that's not to say he's laughing at the KKK, although Topher Grace, terrific as David Duke, did not realize he would be able to handle that role. But it's also just, again, the moments of police work between Spike Lee, directing these actors. Driver's fantastic. He's playing a Jewish character who's a lapsed Jew who's not that religious, but he finds that the deeper he goes into this case, the more he's thinking about his Judaism. And the actor who's the lead of the role, I haven't even mentioned yet, is Denzel Washington's son, John David Washington. So how cool is that? Denzel was making movies with Spike back in the 90s, and now his kid is a star of it. Now, I thought he was fine. For everybody who's saying he's the next breakout star, I would caution against that. I thought he was fine. I didn't think he was the star of the movie. I thought Driver was excellent. And a couple of the guys in the KKK, I mean, they were so good at being so bad and so malevolent. I actually thought his casting was excellent across the board. And he's still got Nick Turturro in there just because, you know, he's an old Spike regular. But I think it's important to note that it's provocative and it's ferocious and it's inspiring and it's going to make you angry. But it's also funny and it's also damn entertaining. I mean, he's got a couple moments that are pure crowd pleasers. The crowd just started clapping. I'm like, you know what? Good for Spike to realize I can make a movie that's important to me, but I want to entertain people. And I think it's a real return to relevance for him and a real success. And immediately people say, well, he's going to win the Oscar. I'm like, listen, it's tough for movies in the summer to be rewarded. But if there's a movie that's going to break through, yeah, that's the one so far. I think that especially, and we haven't gotten into this yet, the whole Oscars controversy about naming this most popular film. As Lyons immediately texted me, he goes, well, if ever there was an award they're going to get Black Panther, this is the one. I mean, what are the nominees going to be? Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, maybe this Mission Impossible film. Only Jurassic World did that well with the critics. But, like, it's going to be those movies. And he's like, so Black Panther's not going to get nominated in the Best Picture race, which, I mean, it's just going to infuriate people. Although, as noted, I wasn't crazy about Black Panther, so I will not be one of those people with pitchforks and torches, depending how the rest of the year goes. But I'm thrilled that Black Klansman is going to get in there. I mean, to be perfectly blunt about it, there were some who were saying, well, you're going to split the black vote. You're going to have Black Panther, Black Klansman, and there are those who like Sorry to Bother You, which is my worst movie of the year. So in essence, I guess you could say Black Panther is going to win the most popular film at the Oscars. Black Klansman, if there's 10 nominees and it's Spike's best movie in over a decade, depending how the rest of the year goes, maybe he's got a shot at a Best Director nomination. God forbid. I mean, it's eluded him to actually win an Oscar. I don't want to go that far. But if Jordan Peele can get nominated for Get Out in February, maybe Spike's got a chance. So that's kind of the backstory to it. But listen, it's a really good movie. So just go see an entertaining, funny movie, which is serious and which is provocative. I'm giving it 4 Maple Leafs. It is my best film so far of 2018. Ricky, have you seen it? Any thoughts on Spike's oeuvre or the film?
Haven't seen it, but I'm about to go on my weekend here from work. Just got back from vacation. It's high on my list. I'm definitely checking it out.
Dan Stanzik all in. I'm willing to do Black Klansman again after our Fleming's dinner this week, but you have to get up at like, 2:30 in the morning, so that's not going to happen. But you just love Spike on the Knicks fandom alone. Then after that, it's gravy.
Oh, yeah. Spike's my guy. I'm all in. And Denzel Washington Jr., let's go.
Yeah, this is definitely in your wheelhouse. A couple more to discuss, one of which is this documentary. So it's the summer of documentaries, and Alec is going to explain that. RBG has been a real success, the Mr. Rogers documentary, which we've discussed. And also this film called Three Identical Strangers. So I want to get into this a little bit. Amazing story. And I'd be curious, like, if Rick's parents or Dan's parents remember this story. Because that was the first thought I had while I'm watching it unfold. I'm like, well, how big a story was this at the time? And this happened in the early 80s. So the documentary, first off, starts out in a really smart way, which is you've got one of the identical strangers telling what happened, which is that he goes to a college dorm, and everywhere he goes, everyone's recognizing him. But they're not calling him by his name. So they're going, well, let's say the name was Jimmy or whatever. Like, hey, Jimmy, what's up, man? He's like, hey, how you doing? And then somebody else is like, hey, good to see you again. Like, yeah, I'm like, oh, remember that time we got wasted last time? And he goes, girls are coming up to me and like hugging and kissing me. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, what universe am I in right now? And then eventually he gets to the dorm where he is a freshman and he meets another guy and he goes, you're never going to believe this. Cause he tells a story now. He goes, like, when I was looking at him, I said, oh my God, it's whoever the name was. You got a twin brother. And he goes, your twin brother was here, and that's why everybody thinks that you're him. He goes, just come with me. Let's go. And they drive there and like literally knocks on the guy's door. His brother answers it, and it's like, oh, my God. And just imagine right now, if I'm telling any of you right now listening, imagine you had an identical brother or identical sister. Like, you've lived your whole life like, wait, what? Plus, he was an only child. That's how he was raised. And oh, my God, I have a twin. So already they're just going bananas, and the story gets picked up by one of the New York papers. And gets published. And then the craziest thing, there's a third brother who sees the story and writes it, goes, oh my God, they're my brothers as well. So you go with that hook to the story, identical triplets who were separated at birth and adopted by three different families. Years later, their reunion now becomes a global sensation. And the reason why I say your parents or everyone's parents listening, it's like, because then you see them on the talk show circuit. They're on Donahue, and they all dress the same way, and they talk the same way, and they smoke the same cigarettes, and they have the same interest in women. They're all like, yeah, a little older. I'm like, all right. And it's like, it's amazing. Like, you're looking in a mirror, all these guys, and they're on the talk shows and the newspapers. I'm like, yeah, they open a restaurant together, and they're identical triplets, and one of them grew up middle working class, one grew up middle class, and they're all laughing. They got one guy, he's the rich one. He's got like a dad's a doctor, mom's a lawyer. Like, oh my God. And now they're all tight. And then you're wondering where the story's going, which is just already fascinating that this is existing and it's crisp and it's good storytelling. And then the big reveal comes, which I will not spoil for you. I know I enjoy a good spoiler heavy review, but I won't want to spoil this for you because A, I think if you want to know what happened, you can just Google it because it is a true story. And B, maybe people remember it, but there's a big hook. And all of a sudden you go, whoa, this story, which was kind of light and frilly, all of a sudden took a drastic downward turn. And then you start to learn more about how these triplets were separated. And now the story becomes like Dr. Caligari. And all of a sudden now it's like Frankenstein. Like, wait, what? There's like government experiments going on and that there was this nefarious plot to separate triplets for the sake of scientific research. And now you go from watching this film, which was, as I said, light and enjoyable, to now you're feeling queasy and uncomfortable going, well, how is this happening? And how sad is this? And there's nothing more depressing. I don't think I had a more depressing moment in a movie this summer when they show a couple of the babies. I don't know if it was the actual twins, but they show the babies together and they said, you don't know how impactful that is to a baby to always be sleeping beside your brother and then all of a sudden to be taken away. And I said, what a despairing thought. I mean, I don't know what everyone's relationship is with their siblings, but just imagine if you had siblings and
you never even knew about it. And like that warmth, like a child, like, you know, when a baby's held by a father or a daughter or parent, like there's nothing like that. And similarly, when it's a sibling, to be in the crib together like that, like it's, you can't even put words on that. And I'm like, just that emotion and the way they tell that story, I said, that's just horrifying that this happened, that these guys were separated. And then they go deeply into the story behind all of it. So I thought it was a terrific documentary. I hope I didn't spoil too much, but I'm giving it 3.5 Maple Leafs. Check out Three Identical Strangers. Ricky, this will be in your wheelhouse. You like a good documentary. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check this one out. I remember reading about it when it was hitting the festival circuits, and I was intrigued by it because I just thought it was the life of three people that were separated at birth, but then all the darker stuff that came out about it. I'm all in on this one.
Dan Stanzik is one of six. His daughters are twins. Could you imagine if...
Sisters. That'd be weird.
Sister. Imagine if Moore and Elizabeth had no idea that they were twins, and then...
Yeah, it's crazy. I can't even imagine. There was this movie on Netflix a few years ago, I remember, about two Asian girls that were separated at birth. The movie's called Twinsters, and they were, you know, it's a happy ending, and I immediately sent it to my sisters and told them to watch it, and they loved it. I didn't know that this film had this dark, twisting ending, and I don't even know if I'm going to see it.
All right, one more for you before we get to Alec Bloom. I'll make this one relatively quick. You Were Never Really Here, which is currently available on DVD. This got released in April by Lynn Ramsey. Fairly noted director if you're into this type of genre of film. But I just, again, the hook, and I've discussed this before, that oftentimes if you compare the movie to something I'm in, and all the reviews kept saying, homage to Taxi Driver, kind of like Taxi Driver, etc. And as I watched it, I'm like, okay, yeah, lonely outcast, back from the war, searching for meaning, tries to rescue a prostitute. Like, as I'm watching the movie, I'm like, why don't you just call it Taxi Driver 2? Like, I mean, essentially, that's what the movie is. But I'm not against that. I'm never that person saying, why are you ripping it off? Because I'm like, no, if you're paying homage, hell, if I was a director, all my movies would just be Raging Bull and Taxi Driver and Goodfellas. I'm like, yeah, just, I love Marty, so I'm just going to make my version of his movies. So I'm okay with that. But I did think that this movie was dark and despairing, and one of those movies that was maybe more interesting than actually a quality film. Joaquin Phoenix is excellent in the movie. I mean, he's, forget about taciturn, he's monosyllabic. Like, he's just got this gigantic beard, and he's this contract killer, and he is surprisingly tender towards his mom, who he lives with, but he's clearly searching for meaning, and he's just a dark, bad dude. And when he comes across a cause that he believes in saving this girl, then he's all in. So I don't think it's a movie for all. I did think it was more interesting, as I said, to talk about it and to think about it, like in film circles and such. But I did think it was a very good movie. I don't think it was great, but it was a very good movie. So I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs. It's currently available on DVD. If you love Taxi Driver as much as I do, if you like Joaquin Phoenix, or if you like Lynn Ramsey's work, I would recommend You Were Never Really Here. Now it's time for Alec Bloom. All right, a real pleasure to bring in Alec Bloom. That's right, Alec like Baldwin, Bloom like Judy Bloom. He is launching a new podcast for Fantasy Movie League called Cinefool, which is clearly inspired by Cinephile, but also... a callback to his old podcast, Unwritten Fools of Cinema, which you can listen to. I'm actually going to be a guest on his podcast next week, but his main affiliation is with Fantasy Movie League, and Alec is going to help us break down the box office winners and losers of this summer. Alec, first and foremost, I know you're a fan of the podcast, so thank you for that, and thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, a huge fan of the podcast. I really love you guys. I've been listening to you ever since you started this thing up. Thank you for having me on, and I think it's very, very cool that you are the only movie podcast on ESPN. I don't know how you pulled that off, but I'm very glad it happened. So,
listen, Dan Stanzik and I figured out a way, man. As Dan once said, what was the expression? You do it, you plead for ignorance afterwards or something like that? What's the exact word?
It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, there you go.
Boom. That's how we do things around here. Dan and Rick and I have talked about this. It's been a fairly underwhelming summer, at least by our standards. I know we're going to focus on the financial dollars. I'm just saying of movies that I loved. If you said to me last year, I'm like, hey, we had Dunkirk, we had The Big Sick. This year, I'd say Black Klansman, Three Identical Strangers is all right. I mean, the documentaries have been a major story. RBG, the Mr. Rogers documentary, Can You Be My Neighbor? But in terms of the big winners, it feels like it's superhero movies and documentaries, which isn't something I thought I'd be saying in mid-August.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, it's pretty much a staple for every summer that it's going to be the superhero movies that dominate, usually Marvel and then whatever DC has coming out. But that's pretty much everything bringing in the money is going to be coming from some sort of superhero. So, but yeah, you mentioned the documentaries, which is probably my number one surprise, really, of this summer, is just how well they did and how many of them there were. I mean, you mentioned Mr. Rogers. Won't You Be My Neighbor? That thing was huge. I think it brought in about $21 million somehow. I don't know how it pulled that off. Then you have, what were the other two? Oh, you mentioned RBG. And when you were talking to me earlier, you mentioned it, my girl RBG, which I wasn't aware that she was. But
here's my thing why she's my girl here, because I completely support what she's about. But I cannot fathom how I can get off my couch. I'm going to go spend $12 to go see this thing, right? But it's been a smash. Like, if somebody said you Ruth Bader Ginsburg, box office star, that's about as tough a sell as I can imagine, yet it's been a big smash, right?
Well, it's huge. It brought in a very impressive $13 million. And, you know, who knew the notorious RBG would represent like that? But you don't know, now you know. I personally haven't seen it. I don't know if you made it out to the theater to see it. It sounded like you weren't ready to get off your couch for it. To me, that's going to be a rental. But actually, I haven't seen any of the three big documentaries that we have here. You mentioned the Three Identical Strangers as well. But, you know, all three of these that we mentioned cracked the top 30 of all time as far as, you know, box office dollars for documentaries, with Mr. Rogers residing just outside the top 10 at number 12. Didn't see that coming. We didn't have a whole lot of successful documentaries last year. I think we had Born in China from Disney. I think that was really the only big one as far as box office dollars are concerned. But yeah, very, very impressive performance from the documentary genre.
So the docs do well. Superhero movies, I mean, Deadpool 2 did well. Obviously, Avengers Infinity War, maybe it's a little bit before the summer, obviously was a smash. But Star Wars, I think that's the headline, right? Did not do well. And in fact, it was such a disappointment, they're going to discontinue making some of these movies.
Well, supposedly. You never know with over at LucasArts there, if they're going to be... They can change, you know, pretty much. They're very much like MoviePass. They can change from week to week what they say they're going to do or what's reported from the studio of what they're going to do. But Solo, I mean, the production issues were well documented and chronicled. It's really, that was another big surprise for me. Not so much that it pretty much failed at the box office, but that Ron Howard somehow righted that ship and was actually able to come up with a competent blockbuster movie that, you know, that had some mixed reviews, but it wasn't a horrible movie, and it probably should have been. But a Disney movie, let alone a Star Wars movie, not making money is kind of unfathomable, actually. And it's hard for me to believe that, but there we are. Solo, a Star Wars story, not making money.
It is bizarre to think that way. You know what I thought? I read the other day about comedies. There was no major comedy this summer. Every summer you go, yeah, there's a Hangover, there's an Amy Schumer train wreck. The biggest grossing comedy of this year is Game Night, which grossed $69 million. How'd that happen? How are there no big budget comedies everyone's going to see?
There's just not a lot of inventive comedy out there, unless, I mean, I will argue that Deadpool 2 is pure comedy. I really don't even consider that in the superhero genre. I know I get some pushback on that, but I mean, it is pure comedy. That's what it's trying to be. It's going for the laugh. It's not going for story. Well, we'll argue that Deadpool 2 was trying to pull out a decent story and it failed miserably, but it was very, very funny. But yeah, I mean, what we have this summer, Tag was supposed to be pretty big comedy and it wasn't. You know, it just, everything feels very run of the mill, and you know, there's just not a lot of great comedy out there, especially like with ensemble, like these big ensemble casts and like these supposed to be these big tag like movies. They really underperformed because it's just kind of been there, done that. And so we're not really getting anything, I guess, theater worthy, unless you have something like The Big Sick, which you mentioned that we had last year. That was a very funny comedy, but that was more than your typical run of the mill, you know, popular, you know, some slick, I guess, but we just don't get too many of those, unfortunately. It's just kind of a lot of tag-like stuff.
Yeah, in terms of romantic comedy, Crazy Rich Asians is a good story. Again, kind of like The Big Sick, you're going towards an underserved public in that there's not a lot of films with Asian stars that serve Asian audiences, and that's done really well. And I don't know if it's going to be a true box office smash, but I think that's one of those movies that you go, all right, just might like the Joy Luck Club, based on a best-selling book, does well. Again, underserved market, maybe you'll see more of this because of the fact Hollywood wants to make money. So fine, we're going to have Asian stars in movies. Let's do that then. Let's make more money.
Yeah, and that movie is coming out today, actually. And we talked about it extensively on the actual Fantasy Movie League podcast that we call FML My Life. And yes, we do use the FML acronym for Fantasy Movie League. You know, you're not the first person to recognize that if you're listening. But yeah, we talked about the buzz and the hype and the basically the trend that this movie, Crazy Rich Asians, that it's on right now, it's poised for a big breakout this weekend. And yes, it's both comedy and, you know, that rom-com genre. But obviously it's something fresh. And as you mentioned, it's the first predominantly, you know, Asian cast since Joy Luck Club in like 93. So it's been a while. And as you said, very much underserved. So that has a chance to actually be a very, very big breakout star. You know, it's, like I said, it has the early opening with being like a Wednesday and Thursday before the weekend. But you know, the weekend, it could bring in 25 to 30, maybe 35. That would be pretty crazy, but I don't know. We'll see.
Spike Lee's Black Klansman opened 10.8 million, fifth place, but I know it was only 1,500 screens. What's a realistic number for this movie, which I think is the best of the year so far? He obviously won the runner-up prize, the Cannes Film Festival, Spike did, and the movie did. I think he's got a shot at least getting nominated for an Oscar, especially now at this new category, which I think Black Panther is going to win most popular film, and I think Black Klansman might be able to actually get into the Oscar race. What's a good number for Spike? 30 million, 40 million, 50 million?
Well, it depends on, I have to look more closely on what its theater expansion is going to be, how many more theaters it's going to add. Usually if something opens up very well like that, like you said, it's about 1,500 theaters, they're going to go ahead and move it into a few more theaters, especially since we're at the end of summer and there's not a lot of tentpole movies out there. So there's plenty of theaters, theater space. So I don't know, 10.8 million. I mean, it could definitely do, depending on how it legs out. I mean, it can do 30 to 40, maybe close to 50, then maybe a bit of a stretch. But I think that 30 to 40 range, and that's very, very solid, especially for these indie flicks. That's a lot of money.
You know, I think Tom Cruise is a loathsome cretin, but apparently people tell me this latest Mission Impossible is one of the, my friend Cab says it's like a top five action movie of all time. And I know it got whatever 97% Rotten Tomatoes. We'll have to get Ricky and Dan to see it on my behalf because, you know, I just can't do that. But financially, did it do well compared to the other Mission Impossibles? Please tell me it didn't do well, like in relation to budget or something, or like China is not interested in Tom Cruise.
And I'm sorry, pretty much most people are interested in Tom Cruise despite his extracurricular activities. Yeah, and I will admit it was one of my favorite movies of the summer, so I'll throw that out there right now. But, I mean, it opened to $61 million its opening weekend, which was a franchise best. I mean, it's holding very well.
That's all the time we have, Alec. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast. All the best.
Well, okay, so it's now at $161 million, which is actually number six right now for the summer box office list, and it's going to climb that, probably make it on the top five, very possibly. Yeah, you mentioned the 97% Rotten Tomatoes score, 86 Metascore, which all of this just means only one thing. Your Tom Cruise boycott must endure for many, 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 many more years, unless, of course, you know, one of his death, I can't talk, unless, of course, one of his death-defying stunts finally does him in. It's very possible.
Yeah, see, you're telling me there's a chance. Lastly,
there's always a chance.
You told me there's some trivia you have. Is this? I'm hoping this includes Dan and Rick as well, but you have some trivia for us? I don't know if this is Cinefile related or summer box office related. What do you have?
Well, let's just say it's a combination of both. It's mostly related to the box office, but it has a bit of a cinephile twist to it, I guess.
All right. Well, Dan and Rick are full attention. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. You need all the help that you can get here. All right, let's start off. I've got five of them here for you. Right off the bat, Paul Giamatti's highest grossing movie, and we're talking domestic here.
Okay.
Sideways?
No, I only Sideways made that much. Cinderella Man only made that much. Private Parts?
No.
Ricky, you want to wager a guess? Stan's going to are doing correctly, which is just going. I think Ricky's cheating and actually Googling Giamatti's list.
I am not Googling.
He's on Box Office Mojo right now, isn't he?
But it's good. It's a good one. You know what? He was in Saving Private Ryan. It's a small role in Saving Private Ryan.
You're so close. It's actually, I think with inflation, that definitely would be number one. But it's Hangover Part 2. Oh, he had a very small role as a gangster or something in there.
Yeah, he was terrible.
And then there was
I adored you, but it was not a good role. He looks like inflated, and did you speak of inflation? He looked inflated in the movie. The movie was awful. Oh, that's disappointing. Giamatti's highest.
I didn't know you were capable.
That's tough.
I didn't know you were capable of saying such harsh things about Paul Giamatti. There,
I adore him, but that's, listen. I gotta tell the truth here. What's the next trivia question?
Okay, so which actor has grossed more money at the box office in their career? So we're talking about the money their movies made, their box office grosses. You know, not the individual actor's salaries. Right, so which actor has grossed more money at the box office in their career? Paul Giamatti or Al Pacino?
So this is, sorry, you said not to inflation, right? This is just total dollars.
That's correct.
All right, so then I would think, well, Pacino's done a lot of movies, though, man. Al's just done like 50 movies. He's just done more movies than Giamatti. He doesn't, and I mean, if you adjust it to inflation, obviously The Godfather's enormous, but I will go with Pacino just on length and duration.
You'd be incorrect. No, Giamatti has 1.9 billion to Pacino's 1.45.
Are you kidding? Wow. Like, Paul Giamatti's movies would be $450 million more than Al Pacino's movies?
Yeah, well, you just have to think about what Giamatti was in. So you have those big tentpole movies. He was in one of the Spider-Man movies. He was in, you said, Saving Private Ryan. He was in The Hangover Part 2. That, right. Those add up, you know.
And just not enough people saw Simone. Poor Al.
Yeah, not, including Alec right here. All right, next question. A very similar question. I'm going to give you the lifetime grosses of the four actors. Or I'm going to give you lifetime grosses of four actors, and you have to match that actor to the number that I give you. Yep. You're going to need some help from the guys here.
Yeah, Dan's got the pen ready. We're ready to go. Yep.
Good. Okay, your four actors are Bobby De Niro.
Yep.
Eddie Murphy.
Yep.
Stanley Tucci.
Love Tucci.
And Tommy Cruise.
Oh, jeez. I was going to say, I love how you're giving this to me, and then all of a sudden you're going to get that.
All right, so here's the number. The numbers. You have $3.2 billion, mm-hmm. $3.7 billion,
yep.
$3.8 billion,
yep.
and $3.9.
Listen, I'm just thrilled.
All you're doing is just putting them in order.
I am thrilled that Stanley Tucci has movies are over $3 billion. Like, that's amazing. Like, I love Tucci. I'm going to go Tucci $3.2 billion.
That'd be incorrect.
Oh, so I'm already off, okay. Let me go to my guys here. Ricky and Dan, do you guys want to, before I start guessing, hang on, let's go. Dan's got a list. Let's go with Dan's first.
Do it.
I'm going to say Tom Cruise with 3.9.
You'd be a wise man there, yes.
Okay. Number two at $3.8 billion, is it De Niro, Murphy, or Tucci? Ricky?
It's Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy at $3.8 billion, Alec.
That is correct. He has a ton of those family flicks, and those things always break $100 million. So, yes.
So you're telling me that De Niro comes in last year at $3.2 billion?
Yeah, well, you have to think about Tucci. Hunger Games. He was in every one of those movies in the franchise.
Yes.
$1 billion right there.
Big tentpole movie. Yeah, yeah. So, poor Bobby.
All right.
He tried with Dirty Grandpa. He tried getting back into the big blockbuster game, but...
Molly Karen, big fan of that movie, yeah. Number four, what do you have for us?
All right, so we only have two more questions left. So just in that same vein, because apparently I really love this category, can you name the top five grossing actors of all time? So like I said, it's in the same vein, so we're talking their movie grosses, you know, not their individual, you know, salaries.
Sure.
Can you name the top five?
Tom Cruise.
Hint, Tom Cruise is not in it.
Not in the top five. Yes, that is good news. DiCaprio.
No, DiCaprio.
Hanks.
Hanks is number four.
I feel like we're playing Family Feud.
Good answer. Hey, good answer. Yeah, yeah. I just love the clapping. It's my favorite part. Ricky, give a guess. Danny was good with Hanks. What do you got?
Denzel.
Denzel Washington.
No Denzel.
Ah, racist.
Wait till I give you the rest of the list, Ed, and calm down.
Give me Matt Damon.
I will not give you Matt Damon, no.
Brad Pitt.
No Brad Pitt.
Okay, Johnny Depp.
No Johnny Depp. Okay, no, listen, we'll check that hard.
I'm going to give up now. Ricky, you want an answer?
How is it not Depp, all those Pirates of the Caribbean movies?
All right, give us the list,
you'll see why. All right, so number five, you have Morgan Freeman. Yeah. I think he was in the Nolan Batman movies, and he's just been in a ton of stuff, too.
Yep. Oh, Sam Jackson?
Then you guys got Sam Jackson's number one.
Yes, Sam Jackson is number one.
But think about it. The Avengers movies, every single one of them, he's, I don't know, maybe two of them, he doesn't make an appearance. So he gets credit for every single time he appears as Nick Fury in a movie. And those things always crank, you know, half a mil plus, you know.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so Morgan Freeman, five. Tom Hanks, four. Robert Downey Jr., so another Avenger, number three. The number two was a little bit of a shock to me, but maybe it shouldn't be. Harrison Ford is number two.
Shouldn't be, but you're right. It's a star. You forget about it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Air Force One.
Yeah, when you have those tentpole movies, yep.
Wow, you're embarrassing us here. This is great. What do you got for the last one?
That was the plan, and we'll see if I can continue that. Final question. This award-nominated movie was snubbed for Best Picture at the Oscars. made very little money at time of theatrical release, but audiences eventually found it on
Shawshank
DVD
Redemption.
And TV.
Shawshank Redemption.
All right, so it has a modest, quote-unquote, modest cult following, 85% of Rotten Tomatoes, plus cinephiles absolutely adore it. So you can answer the same thing if you want. I'll give you multiple choice here. Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, Shawshank Redemption, or Weddings and a Funeral.
Wait, did you say it was nominated for an Oscar?
I just said it was award nominated.
Yeah, so it's Shawshank Redemption.
Actually, it's a trick question. I was looking for Grandma's Boy. It has an 85% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. It made only $6 million at the box office in 2006, but allegedly pulled in over $50 million in DVD sales and rentals. It is cinephile approved by Rick Passmore. Rob Schneider was nominated for Worst Actor of the Decade Razzie in 2010, with Grandma's Boy being one of his movies, of course. And as you may know, it did not win Best Picture of the Academy Awards. But to be fair, Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film was not yet a category. So there you go. Mission accomplished. I did make you guys look like fools in my trivia. That's all I was trying to accomplish here, guys.
Well played, Alec. Alec Bloom getting it done. Cinefool is his podcast. He is, of course, a part of Fantasy Movie League, FML. Be a part of it and play it. You know, the movies I love, Alec, as you know, are not the movies that make the most money, but I like playing it just because it reminds me what movies are coming out. So it's okay, well, great. We got Mile 22 out this weekend. And then, you know, I don't really care how I do in the actual FML. But I love the site and I love the app just to remind me what's happening. So kudos for that. Your boy, Matthew Berry, and for doing such a good job with us. And I look forward to chatting with you and your podcast next week.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ed.
Giamatti forever.
All right.
When tracking the domestic dust bunny, you commonly find them hiding under wardrobes next to lost socks. Don't move too suddenly or they'll scurry off. What's utterly fascinating about the Dust Bunny is that although they are not actually sentient creatures, when they hear that Geico not only saves people money, but also has a 97% customer satisfaction rating, it's obvious to them you should switch. Because, yes, switching to Geico is a no-brainer. Oh, no, it's the Dust Bunny's only natural predator. Run along, Dust Bunnies, run along.
All right, so that was Alec Bloom. Thanks again to him. He was terrific. I got a few more movies to review before we get to the rest of the regular segments here on Cinephile. Also, I buried the lead, so I got this FedEx envelope today, and I got really excited. I said, oh, man, it's award season. Somehow Lyons has figured out a way to get me into the Broadcast Film Critics Association. I'm going to start getting movie reviews. Instead, I open it up here, and I said, what in the world? And it's a People Magazine special edition. And it says, hi there. Just want to draw your attention to the special edition of People Magazine dedicated to NBC's Emmy Award nominated hit series, This Is Us. This issue is a great retrospective on the first two seasons of the series, pivotal episodes, memorable scenes, cast interviews, as well as a sneak peek of what to expect for season 3, which begins Tuesday, September 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern from Chip and Natalia. Now that I've mentioned that, the first person who tweets Cinephile, and you can just write, This Is Us. You can go ahead and get this People Magazine, which Danzig and Rick Passmore are going to send you, because I'm not going to be reading this. That's your first free gift giveaway here, but This Is Us. Just going to tweet, This Is Us. I also have a book. I reviewed the Nick Nolte book. At the end of the podcast, Passmore will have come up a question, either specific to Nolte or specific to Cinephile, and you can win my, you know, I'll go ahead and autograph it right now. My free autographed copy of Nick Nolte, Rebel, My Life Outside the Lines. It is autographed by yours truly, and it's a terrific look at one of America's finest leading men. All right, so back to the movies. I know foreign films are not everyone's taste, so we'll do this relatively quickly. First one I want to talk about is The Insult, which is the story about set in Beirut in Lebanon between a Christian mechanic and a Palestinian Muslim man. So what happens is the Palestinian Muslim man runs a construction company. They're going around to clean some of the places. And he starts replacing some equipment there. The Christian guy comes out in his balcony. He's like, hey, get out of here. Like, what are you doing? He's like, no, we're going to replace these. We're from the city. He's like, no, get out of here. He goes back. And after the Palestinian guy is done cleaning it, Christian guy goes back and just puts like a sledgehammer to the thing that he tried to fix. And the Palestinian guy's down there, like, just incredulous. You know, calls him an effing prick, and I hope we can say prick. And then he comes back, sprays a little water on him, and Palestinian guy goes back, and his boss tells him, listen, we got a real situation. This guy complained about you. You got to go apologize. He goes, hey, I was just doing my job. And all of a sudden, he was furious with me, and he broke it. So I called him a name, and he threw some water on me. He's like, well, you got to go back and apologize. He's like, all right, fine. So he goes with his boss. They go to meet where this guy works as a mechanic. And it's a very heated confrontation. Very quickly, because the Christian guy doesn't want to hear it. The Muslim guy doesn't want to apologize anyways. And then eventually he hurls the insult. which is the title of the film. So immediately I'm like, oh, what is the insult? And how could you base an entire movie on an insult? After what the Christian guy says, Palestinian guy punches him, assaults him, ends up breaking a couple of ribs, and then this becomes a huge court case. Mechanic sues the construction worker, and now you've got a country, which I don't know how everyone is familiar with the geopolitics of Lebanon, but it's fairly split between those two faiths. And so now you've literally got, you know, one side's on one side's on the other, and you've got this whole exploration of politics and faith and how it deals with that. What I found fascinating about it was that you start to worry about words and to say, you know, the poisonous aspect of certain words and insults, and if ever assault can be justified or exonerated. And that's what the court case ends up becoming, is that did what the guy say, did it justify violence? Is there anything you can say that can justify violence in this case? So I thought about it because, you know, you actually just think to yourself, is there anything I would physically assault somebody and then I think I could get away with it? Because I think the honest answer is no. Like, whatever you say, as hateful and as mean-spirited as it can be, you can't punch a guy, like, period. But the movie kind of goes into different directions, and there's a couple surprises to it. Keith Law, who is, of course, a good friend of ours and loves a good foreign film, he thought it was a little formulaic, but he goes, it's fascinating, and I agree with him. It's very gripping from start to finish. You do kind of connect the dots and see where it's headed, which is why I'm going to give it only 3 Maple Leafs. But, I mean, at the same time, I do think it's a journey that's worth exploring. And I love seeing the documentary with Ziad Dufouri, who is the director, who's Lebanese, but he's been in America for 18 years. But he went back to shoot it in Lebanon. And he goes, I didn't think there'd be enough good actors there. I thought I'd have to go to Egypt or Tunisia. But he goes, I found these great actors. And the guy who defends the Christian, great lawyer. And the whole time I'm thinking, he's like James Mason in The Verdict. I'm like pumping my fist watching the doc when Ziad goes, I had to find a great actor. And I was worried if I had to find an actor in Egypt. And he goes, you know, I need a James Mason type. And the interviewer, Richard Pena, is like, yeah, The Verdict. He's like, oh, The Verdict is one of my favorite films. As soon as I made a courtroom drama, I had to have, who is going to be my James Mason? I'm like, yeah, exactly. This guy's like James Mason. He's awesome. He almost steals the movie because he's so good the way he just attacks this guy and saying that, like, he is like so mean in certain instances. He goes, oh, when are the Palestinians going to stop complaining about the fact they've been marginalized? Like, we got it. He goes, what about the gays? What about the Jews? What about the blacks? Like, everybody's been pushed apart here, okay? Just because your people have, like, we have been, Lebanese Christians, because we've been criticized in this country. We've been attacked by violence by the PLO. So there's, I mean, at times it is a very heated topic, and I'm sure if somebody is really familiar with that terrain, they'd find it very interesting. But do you guys want to know what the insult actually is, or should I just pretend people are actually going to go find this foreign film here?
I kind of want to hear it.
Yeah. I think I should just tell you, because I don't know if people are going to be like, well, what is the actual? So the insult he says to him, the Christian mechanic first starts out just by saying, like, hey, we don't want you, or that kind of thing. Which, by the way, Ziad pointed out, because I found this fascinating in the interview. He goes, you're watching this to foreign audiences. He goes, oh, we want other people to see this. He goes, well, how did the Christian know that he's Palestinian? To be blunt, he goes, they all look Arab. So he goes, how is the audience going to know which religion a guy is? And how does the Christian guy know, first of all? And he goes, well, in the movie, he even says, I could tell by your accent that you're Palestinian. And he goes, but it's subtitled. So for a foreign audience, how can you tell that a guy's accent is even different? And he goes, well, I thought about the italics being, or sorry, the subtitles in italics when one guy talks and the other guy talks. He goes, but then I thought it'd be a little bit too much. He goes, what we ended up doing is just having the mechanic later on in the courtroom scene just explain it so I could tell by his accent I knew a bunch of Palestinians, et cetera. But I just thought that was interesting. When you're marketing to a foreign audience, how do you make an accent translate when nobody understands the language? The insult he says to him is, he goes, I wish Sharon had killed all of you people. And so that is the line that gets him, because he's kind of just saying Palestinians shouldn't be here. But he goes, I wish Ariel Sharon had just finished the job and killed all of you. And he goes back and punches him. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, wow. And in my head, I was thinking, I'm like, you could literally, it made me think of Spike and like Do the Right Thing, that famous sequence where they're hurling racial epithets. I'm like, if you went through every ethnicity, like every person's background, I'm like, hey, what's the most hateful thing you could say to each person? I'm like, yeah, to a Palestinian, that's probably as bad as it gets. But credit to the movie. It does not, I'm telling you right now, it does not layer sides. It really does show, hey, Christian Lebanese have been the target of protests as well, and they've been victimized. So don't always go on one side. And the way it goes back and forth, it really is smart and engaging. So that is the insult. I'll give it 3 Maple Leafs. I bought the Blu-ray. Maybe I'll offer up the Blu-ray for people, because I don't know how many people are actually going to go and see it. But it's a really good movie. Now we'll go a little quicker. Loveless is a Russian film. I just gave it to Passmore. So I saw all the foreign films. I've caught up 6 months late. A Fantastic Woman is the one that won. I'll do this one even quicker. It's about a trans woman who loses her lover and has to go through her life. To be honest with you, I thought it was very much a film of the moment. And I think that's a big reason why it won the Oscar. Obviously, trans politics are a very big story right now. I thought the lead actress was terrific. It's got a great title, by the way. A Fantastic Woman is a great title. But this is my biggest thing with movies. You got to have character and plot. Most box office films are all plot, no character. It's all action. And a lot of indie movies and foreign films are all character, no plot. It's just the story of this person and what's evolving. And in the case of A Fantastic Woman, it's just way too much character and no plot. Literally, the plot is the lover dies, and then her lover's ex-wife is like, hey, I don't know what was going on with you and my ex-husband. Like, you're not allowed to come to the funeral. We have kids. Like, I don't even know what I'm looking at. Like, she's just ostracized with the community. And then it's just, what's life like for a trans woman after she's lost her lover? And I'm like, okay, while that is an exercise in empathy, and again, I thought it was well acted, and it's a story for an underserved audience, it doesn't make a compelling movie. There's just no interest in what actually happens. There's no three-act structure. I'm like, all right, got it. And kind of flatlines. So I wasn't surprised that it won the Oscar, but I from the movies I've seen, like The Insult to me was much better. And this movie, Loveless, I think might be even better, this Russian film, which is by a filmmaker who has been previously nominated for an Oscar as well. But how about this for the tagline? A missing child, a marriage destroyed, a country in crisis. There's your feel-good movie for a Friday night. Go check out Loveless. Even the movie title, Loveless. I'm like, all right, that's the kind of movies you're into, huh? But yeah, it's as simple as that. This couple is relatively estranged, even relatively. Forget the relative. They're estranged. They don't like each other anymore. She's got a boyfriend. He's got a girlfriend. They just have a son in common. They're finalizing their divorce, and then the kid goes missing. And what's crazy about the movie is that you would think to any parent, there's no bigger nightmare than a missing child. And yet to these two, it almost feels like an inconvenience. And there are some scenes of hostility between these two, some like epic sparring and bickering. It reminded me of some of the best of a Cassavetes film. Like, you think of Faces. I mean, John Cassavetes, for those who aren't aware, father of the independent film movement. Shadows was the first indie movie ever, 1959. I love his film called Faces, which is about a marriage and their argument and bickering. And he's got some really visceral scenes in his movies. A Woman Under the Influence, 1974. Gina Rowland's a good movie as well. But this movie reminded me of, like, the best of a Cassavetes. You hear the expression of his movie people. It's kind of like Cassavetes. This was, like, the best of Cassavetes, just the grittiness of it. And the way it's shot, like anybody, and I don't think many do, but anybody who thinks that Russia is glamorous, you watch this movie and you go, oh my goodness, it's just gray. It's just bleak. It's unrelenting. And the Russian police aren't even interested in finding the cop. Like, you have to find search groups who are more interested in doing it. And so I thought what was interesting about the filmmaker is he's taking a personal story about two people who are very apathetic and then relating it to the entire country. And it becomes a social critique of Russia under Putin's rule, that empathy is now gone and people don't care about each other anymore. Also amazing, he even gets the film made. Like, I was like, I don't even know how this guy, I don't know if he lives in Russia, but I'm like, my goodness. Like, I know the backstory here, the KGB and stuff. Like, how does he get the movie released? But it's awfully damning. And the movie is open-ended, but I thought it was really well made. So if you're up for a fun night at the movies, Loveless is the one I recommend, Three Maple Leafs. And now we go rapid fire. Teen Titans Go. If you like the TV show, you like the movie. I don't really know the TV show that well. But I Took the Boys, it's fine. 2.5 Maple Leafs. Will Arnett's great. Will Arnett plays Slade! And they keep thinking that he's Deadpool. And he's like, no, I'm not Deadpool. I'm Slade. And they keep repeating his name. Arnett's always worth the price of admission. He's a great voiceover actor. Teen Titans Go, if you like that kind of thing. 2.5 Maple Leafs. And Hotel Transylvania 3. It's fairly vapid, but it's colorful. Adam Sandler, again, using the same jokes as the past. I don't say blah, blah, blah. We'll give it 2 Maple Leafs. Pleasant enough time waster. Those are the movies that we needed to review.
A Hollywood career spanning decades, and the tales of Tinseltown are told here. Inside the Lion's Den, with Ben Lyons.
Hey, what's up, Adnan? What's up, Cinephile family? Ben Lyons here. In the Lion's Den, as Adnan mentioned, of course, you can download the Lion's Den podcast on Podcast One. But right now, we're on the Cinephile podcast. So, time for a behind-the-scenes Hollywood story. Adnan and I were on the Dan Le Batard show this week talking about Black Klansman, which is the most critically acclaimed movie Spike Lee has done since 2006's Inside Man, one of his, I think, his largest box office to date. That was the first movie I ever actually reviewed on the E! Channel back in 2006. And I remember sitting in the green room. It was kind of a live audition. So they're going to put me on the show, but I was still auditioning to try to get more work with E! And it was the first film I was reviewing at E! And I'm in the green room. And who was waiting to go on the show is Michael Rapaport. And I will never forget Michael Rapaport sitting in the green room grilling me. Let me ask you a question. Who the you. Let me ask you a question. You're going to go on there and talk about the movies? You're like 20 years old. What the f***? What are you going to say about movies? And I just remember having to stand up for myself and review that film. I had to go out on the set and just, I did it in one take. When the stage manager, Tom, who you guys might know from The Soup, gave me like a round of applause and was like, yeah, you shut that Rappaport up. I knew that I was, I did okay. And then I ended up working at the E! Channel for like 6 years. So I want to thank Michael Rappaport for challenging me in the green room back in 2006 when I reviewed Spike Lee's Inside Man.
Actors in three words.
Old school here. This is just for Mark Simon, by the way. Mark Simon and I, he loves the podcast like no other. After he heard we were going on hiatus, he was like, he was in a state of despair. And I was like, listen, we've got vacation here, man. We got to go celebrate. And he was like, oh, geez, I missed the podcast. So just for Mark, this was a few weeks ago, at least maybe a month ago, he asked him.
Yeah, I think it was about a month and a half ago, and these are right from Mark's tweet. We'll start with Chadwick Boseman.
Okay, Chadwick Boseman.
I'm going to go with sneaky old. He's like 43.
How do I say in three words, he always plays like famous black historical figures. Like he does Jackie Robinson. He does like Thurgood Marshall. He does like James Brown. Like, I don't know how you say that. Maybe I iconic black figures. There's my three words.
Saoirse Ronan.
Irish.
You know, I love that movie, Brooklyn.
Pale, which I think often goes hand in hand. Irish, pale, and earthy.
I like earthy. Steve Martin.
This was the easiest one. I saw this. I was delighted to do this. Crazy and funny. Or wild and crazy.
I think you're doing it wrong. We used to do like three actual phrases. Now you're doing like three actual words. We used to do like three separate phrases.
Okay, fine, fine. I'm going to go actually with this. Cerebral. Because that guy is a playwright. He also, eclectic, is it cerebral and eclectic, I'm going for sure.
He's a renowned banjo player.
Yeah, he plays the banjo, for God's sakes. Like, he used to, like, his comedy bits used to have, like, an arrow in his head. He'd play the banjo, and he writes plays. And Martin Short. I'll just say Short.
Speaking of Martin Short, that Netflix special that Steve Martin and Martin Short did, 3.5 Maple Leaps, it's fantastic.
Yeah, Simon told me he didn't like it. Because he goes, I thought you were going to review it. I'm like, well, I mentioned it. Then he goes, oh, it's terrible. But now I'm back in. Passmore liked it. He goes, it was like 2 Maple Leaps. 3.5. Cerebral, eclectic, Short for Martin Short.
I feel like we've done this one before, but Rachel McAdams.
Yeah. Canadian, perky.
Yeah, I think we said like Girl Next Door-ish.
Yeah. We're just cheating the three words. Yeah, Girl Next Door-ish.
I think she got some range too. Maybe range?
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, she was in Mean Girls. She did The Notebook. She did Game Night.
Game Night, she's great.
Spotlight,
you're right. Actually, you know, I forgot. You're right. She's range. Good answer.
And finally, Christopher Plummer.
Canadian, octogenarian, literate. Like, he could do Shakespeare out of the park. In Canada, they have Stratford in the park, and, like, he just does Shakespeare like you wouldn't believe. He's like the Olivier of Canada. He always goes back, like, what do you need me to do? King Lear? Watch this. I'll knock this sucker out, no problem. Then I'll go save Ridley Scott's movie, All the Money in the World. But that's the three words that I'm talking about. All right, Everyman coming up next.
He's just an average man with an average life. And his reviews dictate that.
Oh, right up my alley. First and foremost.
Playing to my strengths.
Dan Stanzik is.
I thought it was a little much.
Everyman.
I just saw Randy, too. Like, he could clearly change up that open. He's got plenty of time in his hands.
Really resent that open.
What direction are we going to go in? Last year with Inside Man, so I like that, A, you had a Spike Lee movie. Maybe you were foreshadowing Black Klansman's coming out. Maybe you just happened to watch it again. The rule generally you like to do is that it's a movie that you rewatch. You were with your family vacation, 5 days, you're living like a Luddite. You had no TV, no computer, no nothing. So in the last week, you must have rewatched this movie.
That's right, and we'll just dive right in. What you got ain't nothing new. This country's hard on people. You can't stop what's coming. It ain't all waiting on you. That's vanity.
Yes.
No Country for Old Men, a 2007 Coen Brothers film, my favorite of theirs, based on the Cormac McCarthy novel of the same name. The title, which I didn't understand until some last-minute internet research, is from the first line of a W.B. Yeats poem called Sailing to Byzantium, which is about the agony of old age and the imaginative and spiritual work required to remain a vital individual, even when the heart is, quote, fastened to a dying animal, i.e. the body. This sentiment is oozing out of Tommy Lee Jones, who plays an aging sheriff in rural Texas in 1980. His opening monologue about sending a boy who killed his 14-year-old girlfriend to the electric chair sets the tone for the entire film. In theory, Jones is our protagonist, but he's absent for long stretches because of our other two main characters. The first of which is Josh Brolin, who plays a poor welder with a young wife that stumbles across a drug deal gone wrong in the desert while out on a weekend hunt. Brolin tracks down the last of the survivors, the ultimate hombre, who is dying underneath a tree and discovers a briefcase packed with $2 million in cash. Our third major player is Javier Bardem, who plays a strange-looking hitman with a terrifying smile named Anton Chigurh that traipses around Texas with some sort of air tank killing machine. He is hired to track down Brolin and the money, so we have Bardem chasing Brolin and Tommy Lee Jones tracking down Bardem in the wake of his murders, but he knows that Brolin is on the run, so he's effectively chasing them both. No matter which hotel or hospital on the Texas-Mexico border Brolin winds up in, Bardem always seems to find him. There are a series of scenes that are chock full of suspense. The two endure close call after close call, waiting in silence, a shootout, and even a phone call. No Country for Old Men is by no means an action movie. Quite the opposite. It's weighty, but it's never boring. It's just that the scenes are not rushed. There's almost a palpable tension throughout, and a lot of that is created by Bardem, who is a revelation. Not only did he win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, his character is thought of as one of the best villains of all time. While he is menacing and gruesome, he appears to operate by a strange set of rules. He seems fixated on chance, fate, and circumstance. There is one scene in a gas station that is particularly chilling. No one in the film really knows how to describe him, but Woody Harrelson, who plays another hitman hired to find the money, says of Bardem that, quote, "He's a peculiar man. Might even say he has principles." Bardem undoubtedly steals the movie, but it's really about Tommy Lee Jones and his reluctance to continue his fight against the harsh reality of society. While I'm giving No Country for Old Men 4 stars, I do have one major gripe, and it's that we never see the conclusion between Bardem and Brolin. That said, it's the best Coen Brothers movie, it has the best villain in recent memory, it was worthy of Best Picture, and it's excellent upon a repeat viewing.
Best one you've done so far, not only because I love the movie so much, but phenomenal villain. Like, I think somebody was at, they did a poll recently of the best villains, and like Anton Chigurh was like number 8, and I was thrilled that people were like, yeah, that is a great villain. Like, normally people mention it, they'll go like Darth Vader, and you go like HAL 9000. But like, I'm telling you, Anton Chigurh could be a top 5, amazing in that movie. What does he say? You don't have to do this. Why? They always say you don't have to do this. They always say that. I mean, the hair's awful. He joked about it. He was like, oh, because when he won the Oscar, he said they made me do this ridiculous hair. And he was, it was so weird being on set. I'm supposed to be so menacing, and people would be laughing at me because of his stupid haircut. But the Coen brothers explained it. They go, we wanted him to look like a prep school kid. Like, you know, that bad haircut when you're a kid. And he goes, it looks boyish on him, and it belies his menace. 3 things. Dave Fleming, shout out. There's no chance Fleming listens to the pod. Dave Fleming, his favorite movie is No Country for Old Men. Although we prefer Adam Amin, because Adam Amin listens to the pod all the time. What's up, Amin? How we doing? Hope the Phillies game was fun. And the fact that Fleming goes best beat, I go, here's my issue. And one of the, which is what you said, the fact you don't see Brolin. But here's the big one. And I kind of like not knowing. I kind of like having to search, and I hope you two can help with this. But I don't really understand the ending. And even people who love the film said after Brolin dies, the movie just kind of goes a little bit. And I'm okay with that. You know, I'm okay with a little bit of detouring. And I find Tommy Lee Jones's last speech to be fascinating and enigmatic, even though I don't really understand it. And I asked someone, they go, well, he's talking about this dream, and then I wake up. He goes, I think what he's saying is that he's now irrelevant. Like, as you said, he can't keep up. He doesn't have the grind. But I hear various theories to it. I just think as a movie, it's interesting. I feel it peaks after the Brolin death. I don't mind that it kind of, like, trickles a bit, but I don't know. I find it interesting. Do you have a specific take on that part of the last 5 minutes?
Yeah, I think what he was saying in this dream is that his father's going ahead in making some sort of fire, and he's going to catch up with him. So he comes from a family of lawmen, and his father never really quit, but he's getting fed up, and he can't really handle what's going on in society with all the crime anymore. So he kind of wants to resign from his sheriff position, which he eventually does, and no one else in his family really did. So it kind of got the better of him, and he had to walk away when everyone else in his family didn't. I mean, he goes and he talks to his uncle, and his uncle's telling him stories about his father, their great-grandfather, and how none of them really quit, and they were all in law enforcement. So I think he's the only one in the family that really couldn't handle it, so to speak.
Yeah, I like it even more now. I like the fact that it, like, you have to think about it. Rick, do you agree with that resolution, or do you remember that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you and Dan. He's basically saying that, like the title of the film, this is No Country for Old Men. He can't keep doing what he's doing. because everything's evolving around him and he's getting older and he needs to leave some of this stuff behind. And even with the type of crimes that are being committed over what it is and the type of villain that Shiger is, it's not what he's used to. It's not what he's, you know, been doing his entire life in pursuit of justice. This is an anomaly, and it's something that's showing like the evolution of humanity in time where this, I can't do this anymore. This is not what I'm about. I can't continue to follow this pursuit. I need to let someone else kind of take it over and allow myself to just go off and just live the rest of my days doing what I feel I need to do. You know, the world isn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
And that's what Tommy Lee Jones's final speech kind of alludes to and prophesizes in a way. And the trickling down after the James Brolin's murder, Josh Brolin's murder, and the whole thing of the walking off and those kids kind of witnessing what's going on. And doesn't he, I kind of, it's a little hazy because it's been a while since I've watched it, but with the two kids on the bike, and he gives them like $50 and said, "You saw nothing," or whatever it was. And he just kind of walks off with the limp and everything. You know, it's kind of in passing on this. Here are these two young boys that are a complete blank slates as far as we're concerned. And they're now embroiled with this evil that Anton Chigurh is. And now you have the next scene, Tommy Lee Jones kind of, you know, prophesizing, well, times are changing and it's not up for our generation anymore. It's a weird dynamic to have, and it's a very interesting one at that, to kind of sit and ponder after the film.
Yeah, it was a really daring way the Coen Brothers at the end of that movie. I remember sitting there going, like, it's atypical of what you're thinking, which is just, it's a cat and mouse game, right? We're trying to chase the killer, here's what's going to go down. I'm like, wow, they kind of went in this lamenting of the past. The other issue I have is this: as great as it is, I was upset when they won Best Picture. As much as I love the Coen Brothers, I was upset when they won because I wanted There Will Be Blood to win, and I wanted Paul Thomas Anderson to win Best Director. And it's funny, they said that they were shooting actually in very similar areas, I believe in West Texas. So like P.T. Anderson, the Coens, I wouldn't say they were going for coffee, but they were aware of what was happening. They were aware that they were both making these really gigantic, grandiose period pieces. And I did think interesting when the New York Times did that list, the best ones since the century, There Will Be Blood ranked high. I don't think No Country for Old Men cracked their top 20. It's interesting that as great a movie it is, I don't think it was the best movie of that year.
When a film critic and director don't see eye to eye, Rick Passmore goes in defense of.
Well, Grandma's Boy, Alec Bloom, clearly was a fan of. What else are we defending?
Well, usually when I'm going in defense of a movie, I'm tackling something that critics have panned. But this isn't the case with Bowfinger, the 1999 Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy vehicle written by Martin and directed by Frank Oz.
This is already the best one you've ever done.
While Rotten Tomatoes scores Bowfinger at a certified fresh 81%, it only took in $98 million worldwide on a $55 million budget. And viewers hold a less favorable view of it with 61% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 6.4 on IMDb. This time the critics are correct in their reception, even almost 20 years later. The story revolves around Bobby Bowfinger, a middle-aged aspiring filmmaker who sets out with his life savings, a little over $2,000, to shoot a sci-fi script, Chubby Rain, written by his accountant friend, Afrim. But with his delusions of grandeur running rampant in his head, he plays the con game to get the film made, hiring a studio PA as a director of photography just because he has access to equipment, brings on migrant day laborers as his crew, and cast wannabe actors with big dreams and little talent, including a great comedic performance from Heather Graham. The biggest play is that the film features the hottest action star in the world, Kit Ramsey, Eddie Murphy, without his knowledge. Bowfinger and crew follow Kit around his daily life, shooting scenes from afar and having actors say their dialogue to him with a bespectacled, brace-faced stand-in, also played by Eddie Murphy, for when they can't get close enough to Kit. But what they don't know is that Ramsey, in his heated confidence and swagger, is also paranoid of aliens and pod people. And wouldn't you know it, Chubby Rain is about just that. It's a 90s take on Ed Wood. And while a lot of the industry jokes are quite dated, as well as playing someone's mental disorders for laughs, it is charming, and it is fun, and it's a fun take on filmmaking and ambition. We're still given the fast-talking PG-13 Murphy that encompassed the decade and the arrogant attitude Martin's best known for throughout his career, but there's earnest moments with trying to achieve a dream and a vision. As someone who's experienced fast and cheap filmmaking, I appreciate what Martin and Oz go for in their own vision. Coming in at a favorable 97 minutes, Bowfinger pairs well with films like Ed Wood and Get Shorty, and should be a DVD in most cinephiles' libraries. And if you don't want to purchase an optical disc of it, Bowfinger's currently available to watch on Showtime.
Easily the best thing you've ever done. Bowfinger is fantastic. I've definitely seen it twice in theaters. I may have seen it three times. Like, I loved it. I remember I saw it, and I took my cousins, and like, you really love this movie. Like, I think it's hilarious. And I love the Get Shorty Ed Wood comp. Of course, I love movies about movies. Go ahead, Ricky.
Shout out to listener and Twitter follower Gary Campbell, who said, "Did you really just recommend that I watch Bowfinger? That's mean." Well, Gary, this is why I recommended it. I'm going in defensive.
Oh, absolutely. Bowfinger's fantastic. And some big-time shots at Scientology, which is the group that Terrence Stamp is representing, as Steve Martin in the movie calls them, Mind Something. And I love the ending. He says, as a screenwriter, you know, his dream is one day a UPS driver is going to come around the door and give him a script. And I was like literally on the floor laughing. It's in slow motion. You just see Steve Martin look, and there's a UPS driver, and he just hands him a script. And he goes, "We're going to China. They're going to go make this kung fu movie," which is just so absurd. I like a lot of things about Bowfinger. I like Steve Martin a lot in general. If you ever see Martin on Cinephile, I'm telling you, cerebral, eclectic, guy plays the banjo. I got a lot of time for Steve Martin. This was a lot of fun. The next couple weeks, there's not very many good movies coming out, so I'll be honest. I don't know how many movies we're going to review next time, but I did get the Entertainment Weekly fall movie preview, which I cannot wait to dive into. So the next Cinephile, we'll do our best movies of the year so far. So the first 8 months of the year, a little Black Klansman, a little First Reformed, movies like that. And then I'll preview some movies. Here's some movies we're fired up to go see, and then we'll go from there. For Dan Stanzik, Rick Passmore, Ben Lyons, and the entire crew, I'm Adnan Berg. Once again, we'll see you. Before we do that, one last thing. Nick Nolte. So this is the one person who ever listens to the end of the podcast. If you want my Nick Nolte, now autographed book, Rebel, My Life Outside the Lines, on a review, I once quoted Jeff Bevere, the great Toronto Star film critic, as saying, "Nick Nolte has a voice like what?" If you tweet us, Cinephile ESPN, Nick Nolte has a voice like what, you can get an awesome book. Until next time, I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.